Hi, I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, and this week we're bringing you a live show we did a few weeks ago in Salt Lake City. We were on stage at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, thanks to the great folks at member station KUER.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming tonight. We are so thrilled to be here in this gorgeous theater in your beautiful city with all of you, public radio friends, fans. It's a pleasure. We have never done a stage show before. This is something brand new for us. It feels kind of dangerous, in a good way. And that's our theme tonight, because when we sat down to think about coming out to Utah, honestly, the first thing we thought about was danger. I mean, I know, that's probably not the first thing most people think about when they think about Utah, but seriously, we thought about those 70,000 Mormon pioneers trekking across the plains and through the Rockies. Was a dangerous journey made for dangerous ideas? Utah is a place where people come to drive 600 miles an hour. That is insane. On salt flats. To backcountry ski in avalanche country. I met people here who do that. There are people sitting here who do this. That also seems insane. There are people who come here to double flip snowmobiles. What is that? I mean, where we come from, we think it's dangerous to double park. Utah is so dangerous, you guys have a place called Danger Cave. I looked it up. You can only go in once a year, and then you have to sign a waiver for them to let you in. But living dangerously does not always have to mean putting your body on the line. I mean, we're public radio people here. We know what it means to take intellectual risks, to tell the truth, even when people don't want to hear it. And the thing is, risk-taking is a skill. It's something that you can practice. You can learn it. You can get better at it. And it can change your life. Our guests tonight are going to show us how. So I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. And tonight, we're living dangerously, beginning with Steph Davis.
Radio listeners, we're watching a video right here. The camera is zooming in on a huge cliff at the top of a mountain, and there's a woman standing right at the edge in some kind of brightly colored suit. As we watch, she jumps off. And she's thousands of feet up in the air. There's no rope or harness or anything holding her up, and she's flying. She's soaring over cliffs and drifting through crevasses. This is Steph Davis. She's a renowned rock climber with a string of solos and first ascents to her name. And a decade ago or so, she found a new and even more dangerous career as a skydiver, base jumper, and wingsuit flyer.
You started skydiving, and I would think that for a climber, that would be so difficult, because as a climber, every instinct must be hang on. And, you know, suddenly you're walking out of a plane or jumping off a cliff. Was that hard?
It was. I mean, these things are such a metaphor, and I think that's why they're fascinating to me and, you know, fascinating to others. So climbing really, it's about holding on. And that can really get into your psyche if you spend your life doing it. And the beauty of jumping and what attracted to me initially is it's the complete opposite. It's all about letting go. And especially for a climber, it's really hard to do that. And so I think for me, it was a very, very good learning experience, which is, I think, what brought me into it.
Well, it's interesting because when you began skydiving, your marriage had just broken up. Your first husband was Dean Potter. And you were really devastated by that breakup and wound up learning to, that's not how most people would get over a breakup, but wound up learning to skydive, which I know you've written about it in your memoir. You described it as a lifesaver. I mean, what was it that was lifesaving about skydiving?
To live through that physical manifestation of the concept of letting go was what I really needed to do right then in my life. And it is kind of the thing that saved me from just this feeling of extreme sadness and anxiety, because as I continued to do this sport, I realized that I actually really loved it. So it kind of started as this, I think, healing experience. And then I discovered another passion that I love as much as I love climbing. And, you know, you don't always get that in life to find that thing that lights you up so much.
Was part of, do you think part of it that, you know, grief has a certain numbness to it, and it can be hard to get out of that. And I imagine just the sheer thrill that the emotions must be so intense when you're jumping or flying.
Yeah, jumping is so much about emotion, and I think that's why it's so powerful. I'm sure a lot of people sitting here have done a tandem skydive.
Really? Wait, could I?
I bet you. If we had some hands. Yeah,
any?
Clap if you've done a tandem skydive.
We're definitely not in Wisconsin.
Yeah, but and I'm sure all those people could tell you that it's something they'll never forget, and this really, really powerful emotion.
What have you learned about fear from all of that? Because you're constantly pushing yourself into scarier and scarier things and confronting fear and working with it, I guess, building a relationship with your own fear, getting to know it. So what have you learned?
So for probably the first decade or so I was climbing, I was always thinking, how can I, you know, get over this fear? How can I not have fear? But now, you know, all these years later, and I've done pretty dangerous things, like really high commitment things regularly.
I like that phrase, high commitment.
I've kind of developed a different attitude toward fear because it's not something I want to kind of stuff down and ignore. I'm at the point where I understand it a lot more, and so I try more to actually listen to it.
Do you try to transform it? Because fear, sometimes I think we feel an emotion and we think it's fear.
Exactly.
But maybe sometimes it's actually excitement, mm-hmm. or it's adrenaline, or it's, you know, something
yeah.
else.
I think fear is very complex, and I think that if we spend a lot of time trying to get away from it, we don't understand those nuances, and so we can feel intensity, and because that's not normal and it's not comfortable, we might think, oh, that's fear and I don't like it. But there's a difference between intensity and fear. At least that's what I think right now. That's what I feel right now.
And the intensity is what you crave?
I think intensity is something that everybody wants in life. I think we like intensity and we need it.
So we haven't talked about the price of risk-taking. You've experienced some of the things that we fear most. You fell in love with and married the base jumper and wingsuit pilot, Mario, Richard, and you two started a business together, and he died in 2013 on a wingsuit jump in the Dolomites. You were there jumping with him on that day. What happened?
We were there that summer to base jump together to fly, and on that jump, I often jumped before Mario, and he would follow me in the flight. And so that's what we did on that jump. I jumped in front, and he followed. So I will never know exactly what happened because I was in front and I didn't see. But when I landed, you know, I looked for his parachute right behind me, and I didn't see it. And so he impacted in the rock during his flight. And it's really impossible for me to understand how that could have happened. It's not like any other accident I've ever heard of and that anyone's ever heard of in jumping. He did have problems with his eyes that were kind of seemed like they were intensifying. Mm-hmm. And I think it's possible that he was having trouble with his contacts that day and wasn't seeing the depth perception like he was used to seeing.
So I mean, to say this was devastating is an understatement. And I know for a while you thought about jumping off a cliff for real with no parachute and no wingsuit, and you didn't, you know? And how did you get through the grief?
It's an experience I don't think I was ready for, and it feels very hopeless, you know, because you don't just lose the person you love the most in the world, you lose your whole life. You lose everything that you were doing together. You lose everything you thought you would do together. It's just suddenly gone. And it's really hard to deal with that. And at first, I just didn't even know what to do. Like, literally, you know, on a daily basis. And so, yeah, of course I thought about, you know, I don't want to be here anymore. Why would I want to be here without Mario? Like, that just seems like completely pointless to me. And so just kind of in the beginning, I thought, okay, well, you know, what do I know how to do? I'm an alpinist. I know how to suffer. That's what you do in the mountains. Literally. You know, you get stormed on, you carry heavy things uphill, you're hungry, you're exhausted. I was like, okay, I can suffer. So I just went into like head down alpinism mode, just I'm gonna endure this and see what happens.
What happened?
You know, after a while I realized that you know, you're not gonna do that forever. It's different to do that for a couple days on a mountain than to do that for your whole life. And I also realized that, you know, Mario was, he was such a special person. He was so about joy. He was about joy, about sharing joy with people, about making other people happy. That's what he wanted in life, to make people happy. And I realized, well, you know, this isn't really that right now. This is sort of the opposite of that. And after a while, I thought, well, I don't just want to endure through life forever. That's not, what's the point of that? I want to be happy like I was happy with Mario and like Mario was happy. And so I said, okay, well, that's my goal now. My goal is to be happy. And I set that as my goal. And after a while, I realized, you know, yet again, that's another lesson that I got from being a base jumper instead of being an alpinist. An alpinist is like, I will put my head down, I will get to the top of this mountain, and I will get back down, and later it will have been fun. You know? And as a, you know, as a wingsuit base jumper, it's like, I am here at the edge of a cliff, and I am going to leave this edge, and I'm going to fly. And I wanted to fly.
Sounds like letting go is part of the key to joy.
Yeah, I think so.
How often do you jump now?
Either every day or every other day.
Actually, I knew the answer to that because you have to tell them how you walk your dog.
Well, I live in Moab, and you know, one reason is it's just a lifetime of amazing rock climbing. You know, everywhere, a couple miles from my house, there's just cliffs everywhere. So usually in the morning, I'll take my dog and hike to the top of a nearby cliff and then jump, and then she'll run back down.
So it's, does everybody hear that? I walk my dog to the top, and then I jump off.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is. It's a nice way to walk the dog because because she goes, you know, she gets twice the run.
Yeah, it's not one I'll be trying for a while. Steph, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Steph Davis. There are a lot of ways to live dangerously. And one way is to stand up for what you believe in the face of opposition from your own community, from people you love. Our next interview features two people who are doing exactly that, trying to reconcile their faith with their own principles. One of them is a documentary filmmaker, and the other is a feminist activist. And what they do may not be physically dangerous, but it's risky in every other way. Here's Steve Paulson.
After spending most of his life in the closet, Kendall Wilcox came out in 2011. A few months later, his employer, Brigham Young University, which is operated by the LDS Church, fired him. Since then, he's made it his mission to shift the conversation around sexual orientation within the Mormon Church. Another person challenging gender roles in the LDS Church is Kate Kelly. She grew up in the church but became increasingly unhappy with the designated role of its women. So in 2013, she founded the Ordain Women Movement, and a year later, she was excommunicated. We are so happy that they could both join us tonight. Please help me welcome Kendall Wilcox and Kate Kelly. So, Kendall, let me start with you. you would seem to be an unlikely person to challenge the LDS norms and culture, given your background. You actually produced films for the LDS Church. My understanding is a lot of those films actually supported what we would call traditional family values, and yet you're gay.
Yeah.
And that's a sin, isn't it?
Well, these days, being gay is not the sin. So acting on it, you know, sexual behavior, that's the sin. But yeah, I mean, I lived with the sort of that bifurcated life experience for at least around 20 years and working for the church and producing shows for example, just about the World Congress of Families. Produced a whole TV series with them about why those principles are important. And yeah, so unlikely, yeah.
So there came a point when it just, it became untenable for you?
Yeah, there came about a decade when it was untenable. But then, yeah, it rose to a head where, I mean, I had gone in and out of different periods of deep suicidality. And so literally, I, you know, had a suicidal moment and sort of had a last-ditch prayer sort of conversation with God saying, if I'm missing something, let me know, because...
We should talk about that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is for... I understand this was a pivotal moment in your life.
Absolutely.
When
yeah.
you went looking for guidance in some way. Tell me what happened. Tell me the story.
I actually was very literally done. So I went to a mountain that I love, Boulder Mountain, southern Utah, and took preparations to end my life. And I had been wrestling for decades, trying different ways, all from within the closet, and couldn't find it. And so was there on the mountain and just thought, well, I guess I have some sort of moral obligation to have one last prayer. But thought, okay, I guess I should say something very begrudgingly. But I did. I said, if I'm missing something, let me know. And what I got was something about really focus on empathy. And I literally was like, what the heck? Thank you.
So you're saying this came out of nowhere. I mean, you hadn't even thought about this. And this, the way you described this, it almost sounds like a moment of revelation.
Exactly. And I actually was begrudging, and I had a choice. I had a choice in that moment of like, well, that makes no sense. I'm just going to finish my plan. But then I just thought, okay, well, I guess, you know, don't give up the gift quite yet. So I literally, as I walked down that mountain on the path, started to say like, okay, what does this mean? What do I go? And that eventually turned into sort of the motivational force behind coming out, engaging with the community rather than doing everything in the closet. So it was life-changing, obviously.
Well, Kate, let me turn to you. You have taken what I would describe as a more active approach to challenging opinions within the LDS Church. On two separate occasions, you, along with other members of ordained women, tried to attend a semi-annual priesthood meeting that was only open to men. Tell me about the first of those occasions.
The first time that we tried to attend the priesthood meeting, we gathered in a park outside of Temple Square in Salt Lake City, Utah, and we walked down. It was a couple hundred women. So we went one by one. Every single woman went up and said, you know, I'm a Mormon woman. I want to be included. I am active. I tithe. And I think that I should be permitted to participate. And every single woman was turned away. It was a real embodiment of the daily, weekly, monthly, yearly lifetime of exclusion that we experience. But it was a very visceral, personal experience where we got to feel what it feels like to be turned away. So
there's a basic question for both of you. Obviously, you are very unhappy with certain key bits of, I don't know if it's church doctrine, if it's church policy. Why not simply leave the church?
Yeah.
Well, I had a graceful exit.
But...
involuntary.
But you didn't want to go. I mean, you were kicked out.
Yes, I did not choose to leave. And that's a question that everyone asks. And I think there's a lot of reasons. First of all, it's not just about me. I could go on and live a happy life, and I do. But there are people who are still involved in the church, like my niece, Ruby, who's 3 years old, who's going to grow up. And when she turns 12 years old, she's going to learn that she is less than. And I don't think that that's right. I think that should change. In Utah, we essentially have a theocracy, and so the Mormon Church dictates a lot of what the policy is.
Okay, Kendall, let me turn to you. Why have you stayed in the LDS Church?
I stay because of the, frankly, the spiritual rigor that it provides me, and that I couldn't walk away without really deeply investigating that. And the more that I have, the more invigorated I've become.
So you're just so I understand this, you're saying that actually you spiritually you feel even closer to the Mormon Church now after all that you've gone through?
Yeah, like I'm definitely more Mormon than I was before. I have tapped into an aspect of who I am as a human being and as a spiritual being through this process of engagement with what it means to be Mormon, what the doctrine is culturally, the history of it, all the messed up things there, to really see who I am spiritually and realize that my spiritual orientation is just as much complex and nuanced and profoundly part of who I am and what I need to be alive as much as my sexual orientation.
So you have, you're very public about all of this, of course. You're working on a documentary film. I mean, you know, people in the LDS Church know what you're up to.
Yep.
Why have you not been excommunicated?
Good question. My approach has been always to focus on the culture and to acknowledge more explicitly and help tell stories and bring to people's attention the conflict that we're really talking about. Not the political thing that we see in the news, not the dogmatic stuff that we hear over the pulpit even, but at the heart of it, there is deep human conflict, and there's tension that we feel from that. And my job is to get people to that place, I feel.
Well, let me see if I, my sense of maybe what differentiates your approaches is, Kate, you're into direct action. You know, you're going up there, you're kind of a bit in the face of what the church is doing here. You're saying, you know, I'm out there, you're going to have to turn me back. Kendall, it seems like you are not directly confronting church doctrine in the same way. In a sense, you're playing the long game here.
Exactly, because I can't change the doctrine. That's not my job.
Kate, why not take that approach?
I think what Kendall and I are doing in different ways is very similar. It's creating space for people like us who just cannot abide with fundamental discrimination and cannot abide with being inauthentic. And so I think whether it's coming out of the closet or whether it's speaking explicitly about feminism and gender justice, what we're doing in different ways is creating space for other people to come forward too. And I think we're doing that in different ways, but that fundamental goal is what we both have.
One final question for each of you. I think I know the answer, but has it been worth it, all that you've gone through? I mean, all that, you know, going up against authority and dealing with some pretty serious personal struggles in the process. Kendall?
Depends on the day. I mean, seriously, I can talk all these lofty ideas, and I do believe them, and I feel them deeply, but it's a day-by-day process for me because there are days where I am absolutely at my bottom and I don't see a way out. There's this line in a poem about, like, in a dark time, the eye begins to see. And I have a testimony of that, that it's that in that darkness, I begin to see the truths of reality, what I'm really talking about, and that gives me hope. And then I do gather one more story of one more person that says, this has changed in this way, and my life is better. And I say, okay, well, then let's keep going.
Kate, has it been worth it?
Yeah, since we're ending with testimonies, I have a testimony of women and the power of women to change and to stand up for ourselves. And so I would say absolutely 100% it's been worth it. It's been difficult and hard and excruciating, but to be able to say, I mean, not many people have a moment in their lives where they can crystallize and look back and say, I had to sacrifice everything in order to stand up for my ideals. And so in the end, it will definitely have been worth it because the church forced me to decide who I was.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
That was Steve Paulson talking with Mormon feminist activist Kate Kelly and documentary filmmaker Kendall Wilcox. Kendall's forthcoming documentary about being gay and Mormon will be out next year. We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, more interviews from our Living Dangerously Live show, recorded at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. This hour, you're listening to an abridged version of a live show that we put on a few weeks ago in Salt Lake City. The theme, Living Dangerously. And up next, Charles Monroe Kane.
Now, our next guest has one of the greatest nicknames you've ever heard, especially for a scientist. She is dubbed the Queen of Canopy Research. Her name is Nalini Nadkarni, and what is Nalini's philosophy? Well, I've been reading a lot about her, and I've come up with one thing. She wants to bring together two groups, the trees and the general public. She does this by collaborating with dancers, rappers, artists, prisoners, fashion designers, and more. Please, please help me welcome Nalini Nadkarni. Thank you. How are you?
I'm great.
Excellent. Now, you've been doing this your whole life, but you fell recently out of a tree. Can you tell us about that? What happened?
Yes, I did fall. And I want to add that that this was the first fall in 36 years of professional climbing, and it was not the fault of the tree. The rope failed. So the trees did not betray me. It was a matter of the rope failing. I fell 50 feet, which is very far.
Yes.
I was in the,
let's reiterate like that. 50 feet is very far.
Yeah, it's like a five-story building. And I fell straight through like a sack of sand. You know, I didn't hit the branches and break my fall. So I ended up on the forest floor. I had some graduate students with me, and they took great care of me. I ended up being helicoptered out after spending about 2.5 hours stretched out on the ground.
Where were you?
This was in the Olympic National Park along the north shore of the Quinault River. So I had some time to think about trees and think about my life, think about what mattered to me, because I really thought, you know, as I sort of felt weaker and weaker and my blood was sort of streaming out of my spleen and so forth, that this could be it.
Yeah.
This could be it. As it turned out, it was not it. I got to the hospital. I got great medical care. I had 9 broken ribs, a broken fibula, broken pelvis. I lost my spleen. I broke 5 vertebrae, and I cracked my cervical vertebrae number 2. So I had I was in the hospital for quite a while. But it was really, and so that, then you think, well, maybe this is what living dangerously is like.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
But actually, I have to say, first of all, I think that we all live dangerously to some extent. You know, I was actually 2 months before this fall, I was walking out of our kitchen in my shoes to feed the chickens, and I fell on my face, and I broke my kneecap. And so, you know, that wasn't seemingly living dangerously, but it turned out there was a sort of a consequence.
We do have a slide, at least, of you leaving the hospital after, I think, can we see that now? How long had you been in the hospital at this point?
It was about 2 weeks, and then I spent time up in Olympia going to doctors, and then I came back here to Salt Lake City, and now it's been about 3 months, a little over 3 months, and I have to say I learned so much. I mean, we talk about the consequences of living in a risky way.
Sure. But have you been back up in a tree? Have you been doing exercise?
I haven't yet been back up. I can't quite do that yet with this spinal fusion I have. But I have to say that, you know, really with the concern and the love of my family, my kids and my husband, who are just fantastic, and my friends, my colleagues, I really believe that in addition to the medical help I got, it was really, I think that the counterpoint to risk is love, is what I really learned. I know that sounds woo-woo and crazy, and coming from a scientist, you know, I hope none of my colleagues is in the audience, but I do believe that
the
it
woo-woo
was
comment that, will be stricken from this
thank
for
you
all
very
scientists.
Much. But what I feel now is that I'm on my way to recovery. One of the things I learned, I think one of the gifts of taking the risk, of having the consequence of a fall like that is that you really learn about yourself. Mm. Because I couldn't go back to work. I couldn't sort of keep going in the rat race that I was on in terms of more papers, more proposals, more students. I had to be quiet, literally. I had to be peaceful.
Now, one thing that you do that I really like is that you do the interdisciplinary thing, that you're connecting with people, but some of it informs your science. I want to show another slide here. And what's interesting about this slide, well, actually, can you tell us what that is? Because this is phenomenal to me.
Yes. So one of the things that has always bothered me about nature documentaries and people who document nature is that they almost always choose to focus on animals. They believe that animals are unique in the fact that they behave, they're mobile, they have sex, they do predation, and therefore they're very interesting, cheetahs and elephants and so forth. And they ignore trees because they think trees are boring, stable, static things that are stuck in the ground, that don't behave, that don't have sex, that can't communicate. And this really bugs me because trees are so fascinating. And if you ever sit up in a tree for any length of time on even a slightly windy day, what you see is that at the twig level, at the small branches and the foliage, the leaves, they're moving like crazy. And so I decided to explore this in order to sort of explode the myth that trees are static organisms. So I tied little paintbrushes with green paint on the ends of the twigs,
yes,
held up a canvas, and allowed the tree to become the artist. And so this is 2 minutes of a Douglas fir in a moderate wind that has just painted this kind of Chinese-y picture that I think is so attractive. But the other thing I did was I measured the length of all the segments that tree had produced after 2 minutes, and I multiplied that number, the number of centimeters of segments of collectively, I multiplied by the number of twigs per branch, the number of branches per tree, the number of minutes per hour and hours per day and days per year. And I came up with an estimate of how far a single tree, a Douglas fir, travels in a single year.
How far does a Douglas fir travel?
What do you think?
Say far, I think.
186,760 miles.
Boom.
So that's 7 times around the Earth.
Now, the thing this idea of something being active, dynamic, that people think isn't, you take it even further. You got that theory, this idea from the trees, and you said to yourself, well, what other things in society that people say are stuck but aren't stuck? And you started working with prisoners.
Right. There's a huge population, in fact, 2.3 million people who are incarcerated in our country. 1 out of 100 people are seemingly stuck. They have behavior patterns, they have lifestyle patterns that many people deem them to be unchangeable, something to throw away. And so one of the things that I and my colleagues and my students have been doing in the last 10 years is to work with prisoners, to bring science and nature to incarcerated men and women in state prisons and county jails. We've started with a science lecture series that moved into engaging with conservation groups to have them teach the inmates how to rear endangered species like the Oregon spotted frog, the Taylor checker spot butterfly, 17 species of endangered prairie plants. And here in Utah, we've started a program with the Salt Lake County Jail and the Draper State Prison where we're helping the Division of Wildlife Resources to restore populations of the least chub. And so inmates who seemingly might be static, mm-hmm, are in fact participating in what I think is one of the most important things we can do, which is to restore the earth.
Now, metaphorically, there's another entity in our society that's stuck that I think a lot of people would, especially in this crowd, would probably really dislike. Maybe we should bring her up here for a second. We can talk about her. Barbie. Now, this isn't any regular Barbie. Her name is
Treetop Barbie.
Treetop. Tell us about Treetop Barbie.
Yes. Well, I have a daughter named Erica, and, you know, sort of to my horror, she wanted a Barbie doll when she was, as most girls do, when they're 6 or 7 years old. And so I decided to sort of counter that, trying to find an alternative to the floofy doll, you know, Barbie that reinforces these sort of negative images of women, and thought, well, why not, again, push the barriers to join together the ecological values of trees with the recreational values of Barbie. So it started as a joke in my lab. You know, we just sort of said, wouldn't that be funny if we had a treetop Barbie? But in fact, we began actually engaging tailors to make her clothes.
Yes.
We made a little booklet talking about the values of forest canopies and really trying to be a role model for girls who wanted Barbies. It was picked up by the Science Times, actually, in the New York Times. And after that, we just began getting all these orders in. We did get a call from Mattel.
Uh-oh.
And they said, you know, you can't do this. And I said, well, we're not making any money. This
Mattel
is...
seems like they'd be big supporters of canopy research. Am I wrong?
Yeah, you would think.
You think, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You
think.
But they said, no, you really can't do this. And I said, well, we'll give you the idea. We're getting lots of orders. Surely this would be a great thing for you. But again, they said, no, shut you down. And I said, well, you know, I've come to know a number of journalists in my town, at the Olympian, at
yeah,
KUER.
Don't mess with journalists.
You know, I think they might be interested in a story of how Mattel is trying to shut down a brown woman who's a scientist to try to inspire others. Science.
You stop the cease and desist.
They said, we'll give you the okay over the phone.
No.
Go right ahead.
Well, I want to thank you very much. I was very inspired by the way you connect with things.
Thanks.
So thank you very much.
That's tree canopy researcher Nalini Nadkarni talking with Charles Monroe Kane. They were in front of a live audience in Salt Lake City. Special thanks, by the way, to KUER for bringing us out there. We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, a conversation with author and conservationist Terry Tempest Williams. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this week we're bringing you a live show we recorded a couple of weeks ago in Salt Lake City. We've been talking a lot this hour about living dangerously and what that means, about opening yourself to the unknown, physically, but also emotionally and intellectually. And really, what we're circling around is a question of wildness or wilderness. And if you had to pick one writer, just one poet who has persistently reminded us of the connection between inner and outer landscapes, who has advocated again and again for the preservation of wild places and the importance of national wilderness, it's our next guest. Here's Steve Paulson.
Terry Tempest Williams is a naturalist and activist. She's the author of many celebrated books, including Refuge, Desert Quartet, Finding Beauty in a Broken World, and When Women Were Birds. She has a new book on the way, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. Welcome with me, Terry Tempest Williams. It is wonderful to have you here, and I was looking back at some of our email correspondence when we started to talk about what we might do for this event, and one of the things you said I found kind of astonishing. You said that the most powerful individual in the American West right now might be the sage grouse. And I don't know if that's still true. I know there has been some legal questions about sort of, you know, the sage grouse and its protected status. But what strikes me so much about so much of your writing is how you bring the sage grouse to life, how you bring so much of the wild to life, wild animals. And so I guess maybe we can begin by exploring what it means to encounter wild animals.
Sage grouse, it could be argued that that's the measure of my judgment, but I think it is the story of the American West. This is a bird that understands ritual, that Native people emulated in their dancing. They once numbered 16 million individuals. Today, it's somewhere between 200 and 500,000. And I think they're at risk. And as you know, on September 22nd of this year, our Secretary of Interior, Sally Jewell, said that it was this great win-win situation that the sage-grouse did not need protection under the law. And I will tell you personally, Steve, you know, I was so angry when I saw that. And my first reaction was, I'm going to write just this really hard-edged, nasty piece. And then I thought, I don't think that's going to matter. And I thought, what would matter? And I went out to the one lek that I know, which is at the end of the runway in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And I went with a friend. We both took our lawn chairs and some champagne. And we found the lek, and we toasted them.
Wow. So why do you need to go out into these wild places, into the wilderness? What does that do for you?
You know, I think I keep thinking it's all about politics. It's these problems that we're facing are political problems. But I actually think that it's not the political crisis that we're facing, but a spiritual one. And so when I have those times with family, with friends and sage grouse or prairie dogs or ravens and hearing those wing beats, a peace settles in. And there's a beauty.
Does it take you to a deeper contemplative space?
I just think it feels like home. It's quiet. And the world is a noisy place right now. And if we choose to engage with it, it gets very noisy. And so for me, it's a return back to my deeper and higher self. Plus, it's joy.
So do you see wildness more as a place, a physical place, or a state of mind?
Both. I think for so many of us in Utah, wildness, wilderness is a place, and we know it by name. But I also do think it's a state of mind. And I think the wild mind is perhaps the most terrifying place of all.
Why is that?
I think there's an inner wildness as well as an outer wildness. And I think if we don't confront the inner wildness with all its terror, then I think we're going to project it outwardly, as we have on wolves. Or if, you know, I keep thinking, why the violence with prairie dog towns? You know, why in parts of this state is, you know, shooting a prairie dog an act of patriotism? I think it has something to do with the inner wildness. And as a writer, it's the most terrifying place I know.
Because you're going to places where, almost by definition, you're leaving your comfort zone.
Not only that, but I don't know if I'm going to find my way out.
Has that happened to you recently?
Yeah. For me, every day I pick up my pencil, I'm faced with my own limitations. You know, I thought this book on national parks would be joyful, it would be easy, it's straightforward, there's no place to hide. You know, I just turned 60. I want to just face what I love the most, public lands. You know, and the way in is through national parks. It has been absolutely the most difficult book I've tried to write.
Really? Why is that?
Because it's a shadowed history, and I didn't want to face that.
The history of Native peoples being displaced so we could have these wonderful parks.
Right. And I've been on the other side of that argument. And I had to face that. I had to face my own racism. I had to face my own privilege. I had to face that there was so much I didn't know.
And it's fascinating to hear you say
terrifying.
That. I mean, you've been writing about these subjects for decades, and you're saying that you writing about national parks, you came onto a subject that you really didn't know that much about?
I knew nothing. And now I know even less, and I'm going to have to be accountable for it. And yet, I feel like I finally found my way in. I'm not a historian. I'm not a scientist. I'm simply a storyteller.
Why was it so important for you to write about the national parks? Why did you want to focus your lens on these lands?
I think because there are public commons, and I love national parks so much. I married a park ranger, you know. It's where our family history lies. But I think it's because it's a mirror of America in all of our complexity. It's all the things we don't want to talk about. It's the best of us. It's the worst of us. I don't think it's our best idea. I think it's our evolving idea. I love how our national park ideal is evolving, and that excites me.
And these are also our sacred lands, too.
They are our sacred lands. Thank you for saying that.
Well, and that's, I mean, I'm just thinking back on all that you've written, and especially how you personally gravitate to the lands of Utah, to the desert landscape, and there's a piece of what I get reading you that almost harkens back to those desert mystics from eons ago. Does that make any sense to you?
I just love birds, and I love being out, and I love the changing light. I just love it. And I don't think it's so much a contemplative, although I think the act of writing is. It's where my identity lies. And it's an uncomfortable place to be, you know? It was interesting at the World Parliament of Religions. One of the speakers, Karen Armstrong, she's now focusing on compassion. And what I loved is that she said, compassion is not an emotion. It's an act. But if it were aligned with an emotion, it would be most closely tied to discomfort. And she said, it is so important for all of us at this moment in time to cultivate our discomfort. Because if we allow ourselves to feel that pain, that unrest, that discomfort, then we will act on it, and that becomes an act of compassion. But if we continue to avert our gaze, if we only see our national parks as pleasure parks of privilege, where it's about recreation or retail, concessions rather than, as you say, contemplation, then the world continues to suffer and we are not engaged in that suffering. And I love that idea. That to me was one of the best descriptions of wildness that I know. It's uncomfortable, but it allows us to develop those qualities of attention and gratitude and awe, which I think will serve us now.
One thing that strikes me about this whole conversation we've been having is how full of paradox it is. And so we've been talking about wildness, wilderness, for instance, and yet also you have written so eloquently about the importance of finding home. And in some ways, home would seem to be the antithesis of wilderness, but maybe it isn't. I don't know.
You know, I think home for anyone is complicated. It is for me. I grew up in Salt Lake. We left. And this friend of mine said, you're the only person who thinks you left because you moved 5 hours south, you know, and grieve your home ground. But, you know, Salt Lake will always be my city. Utah is my state. It's the language I speak. But it's not always a safe place. But it's the place I would fight for.
Yeah. You brought something that you've written recently based on a trip that you took, and it would be a gift if you could read this, and maybe you can tell us where it comes from.
Well, I was thinking about, I thought, okay, the assignment is living dangerously, and the most dangerous thing I could do would be to write something new. And we're living dangerously, every single one of us, by our inability to change in a time of climate change. And Brooke and I just recently got back from Kaktovik, Alaska, which is right in the heart of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And this is what I saw. This is what I saw in the village of Kaktovik. Painted houses on the edge of the sea, boats, trucks, snow machines, women, men, and children, sled dogs chained to stakes waiting for snow, caribou skins, wolverine skins, geese, a boneyard of bowhead whale skulls, vertebrae, and ribs, great white bears swimming to shore, great white bears walking toward the boneyard, great white bears standing among bones, licking bones, becoming bones. This is what I saw outside the village of Kaktovik, a snowy owl standing on a tussock, draped in fog, yellow eyes burning. And when the fog lifted, a forest of large white crosses of Inupiaq elders were standing behind her. And behind them, a line of light, the Brooks Range. It was not a mirage. This is what I remember from the village of Kaktovik. Three gunshots heard at night is a warning. A polar bear is in the village. Three gunshots heard at night. A polar bear is in the village walking. Three gunshots heard at night, and I remember looking out the window. I met a woman named Marie. Marie was dancing in the village, twirling, twirling, twirling in the middle of the road in the village. Her family's fishing camp had collapsed into the sea. There is no sanctuary from the rising seas or the warming earth, only the refuge of our own making.
Oh, thank you.
So, one final question. We've been talking, our whole show has been about living dangerously. You have brought this home for us. If you have a piece of advice for people listening, what does it mean to live dangerously? What can we take away from this evening that we can think about?
I have no idea.
We'll leave that to you. Thank you so much, Terry Tempest Williams.
Thank you so much for being here with us tonight. That wraps up the show. From all of us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, a huge, huge thank you to our terrific guests who made time in their busy lives to be here with us. It was a really quite a privilege to talk with them and share some of their ideas. Thanks to our awesome band, Mido. Big thanks to our producers, Craig Ely and Raymond Tungekar. I think for our first stage show, this, you guys rock. Thanks to all of the terrific people at KUER. You do such amazing work every day. You guys are so lucky to have them. And thanks most of all to you for listening, for coming out, for supporting your public radio station, for caring. Thank you. Keep listening. That does it for our recent live show from Salt Lake City. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our staff includes Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Craig Ely, and Raymond Tungekar. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. See you next time in your city.
PRI. Public Radio International.